who is the rabbi and director of spiritual care at Cedars-Sinai Hospital in Los Angeles. He's responsible for a large chaplain team there. He's served previously in a rabbinic role at the Young Israel in Century City. And he has a PhD from Loyola University in Chicago in bioethics. He's been involved in numerous projects and committees and spoken as a guest speaker and a scholar in residence in many settings around the country. He's the author of two books, A Jewish Guide to Practical Medical Decision Making, and also a second book on Guide to Observance of Jewish Law in the hospital. This afternoon, he will be speaking on the topic of CRISPR gene editing technology, Jewish law as a guide to a unprecedented biotechnology. A pleasure to have Rabbi Dr. Wiener please come and speak to us.
All right, thank you. It's great to be here with all of you. Such an honor and privilege to be with such a wonderful group. As was mentioned, I have the privilege of serving as rabbi in a hospital in Los Angeles. And one of the aspects of my role there oftentimes is to try to provide a Jewish perspective and a lens to our researchers when they have questions about new fields that they are engaged in. And CRISPR is something, I know that it's been mentioned already this morning, and I think it's something that you're familiar with. I'm not going to spend a lot of time going over the basics of it, but we'll go really into the questions that I noticed a number of our researchers were asking me questions about it. It's something that's happening in our hospital, as I know it's happening around the world. In fact, it's something that's developing so rapidly and so relevant that, you know, I put on the first slide there, 2012 to 2018. What did I mean by that? Dr. Jennifer Doudna published her first article on CRISPR in 2012. The first baby that was born that had already been CRISPRified, if that's the right word, CRISPRed, was in 2018, 6 years later. I mean, that's how fast it happened. Of course, it happened in China, and the person got put in jail for doing it. But she won the Nobel Prize in 2020 already just a couple of months ago. The FDA approved the first CRISPR drug. Of course, it's important, and I'm not going to go into all the details of the science, but we know that there's a difference between, and I listed it here, somatic CRISPR and germline gene editing. The CRISPR that was approved by the FDA recently was for sickle cell anemia. That's somatic. That's not something that changes a person's DNA and is passed down. That's basically where a person is donating bone marrow to themselves in a sort of way. It's like almost going through a bone marrow transplant process, but they get their own bone marrow back, just edited. But germline gene editing, which is much more controversial, has the possibility, the potential to completely transform a person's DNA and their germline going forward to be inherited by future generations. And so when the researchers at my hospital started asking me, and telling me things like, you know, this is already going back 5-6 years and saying to me like, Rabbi, we're going to be able to change humanity. The things that are happening, it's happening very quickly. And I thought quickly might mean like 20 years, 30 years, they were saying. It's not just your grandchildren. Like, you're going to see this. It's happening and it's coming quickly. And what do we do with this power that we have over the human genome? And what does Judaism say? Of course, there's a lot of Talmudic discussion of CRISPR, right? It's so new, so where do we go with this? Now, there are a lot of concerns. And in the bioethical literature, there's a lot that's talked about. One of the most common concerns that's mentioned are what's called off-target effects, unintended consequences, things, you know, we still don't know about the entire genome and the role of each of our genes and what might happen when they're edited. I mean, for example, the first CRISPR drug now for sickle cell anemia, we know that it's not just a drug. It's not just a treatment, by the way. It's a cure. It's a cure for sickle cell anemia, sickle cell disease. Of course, at the same time, the person loses their immunity to malaria. Like, we learned that there is a connection in the genome between malaria immunity and sickle cell disease. You might have seen very recent research about multiple sclerosis, MS, and the connection between actually nomadic tribes that lived, that were shepherds, that lived with their animals, so much so that they actually found animal DNA in the genes in graveyards of these people. And they developed such a strong immune system to fight off the animal diseases they were living with that now their descendants, hundreds of years later, are developing multiple sclerosis as their immune system tries to fight something that they're not exposed to. So there's lots of off-target effects. And the truth is, I joked before that the Talmud talks about CRISPR, of course, you know, it's so new. But off-target effects is discussed by our rabbis. For example, Rabbi Saad Jagon talks about, you know, I always joke with my students, could you, if you could CRISPR yourself, if you could edit your genes, you know, would you do it? And they often say, yeah, of course. So I talk to this, you know, in schools, I say, like, what if you could become perfect students? You won't forget anything. You could change your memory so you'll never forget anything. Would you like that? And they'll say, oh man, we would get straight A's if we could have no, if we would not forget anything ever. So Rabbi Saad Jagon talked about this 1,000 years ago. He said, it sounds like it'd be great to have no forgetfulness. Of course, imagine every tragedy you ever experienced, every disappointment, every disaster that was at the forefront of your mind, every second you could never get over it. The Talmud talks about, by the way, talks about, imagine the ability to the Yetzirah, the negative impulse for idol worship. The Bible talks about it constantly, that people could not hold themselves back from worshiping idols. We almost can't relate today. Why do they want to worship idols so badly? So the Talmud says at a certain point, the rabbis excised from our genome, from our souls, the desire to worship idolatry. And they say that at that same time, we lost the ability for prophecy. Somehow it was an off-target effect that the ability to have prophecy was connected with that Yetzer Hara for Avodah Zarah. So there's off-target effects are discussed throughout the Talmud, and this is a real reality today, as we see already from sickle cell anemia and malaria. We don't know what our genome does. It does much more than we are aware of. But not only that, it's not just that we don't know the genome completely, because I'll mention in a second. There's one other issue, which is that what about malicious individuals, bad actors, or states that could try to take advantage of this technology and pervert it and to intentionally harm others? Whether that is, you know, unleashing, you know, destructive mosquitoes on populations, or rogue doctors or biohackers that use it in irresponsible ways, or countries that develop, you know, incredible armies where they have humans that have developed infrared vision and bulletproof skin and giants, and or whether it's through sports that some countries decide they're going to win all the Olympic games because they have the ability to overcome any kind of physical things that would hold them back from athletic greatness. Now, these are some of the, you find in bioethic literature, these are some of the concerns that are mentioned. But the issue with these concerns is they're not a reason not to pursue CRISPR. These are not intrinsic concerns. Meaning intrinsic concerns would be something that, let's say that when it came to embryonic stem cell research and the Catholic Church, not necessarily in Judaism, but they had an intrinsic concern with embryonic stem cell research that it was a form of abortion. Unfortunately, this is relevant today again in Alabama. But there are certain things they saw as intrinsically concerned. There's no way around it because it is immoral. But these concerns, off-target effects or malicious individuals, they are things that we can get around them. We just have to understand the genome better. We have to have very careful experimentation, ethical research, strict guidelines. You know, there are ways around these concerns that don't have to say we prohibit CRISPR as a result of them. There's also very significant social justice concerns with CRISPR. Gene editing could increase inequality since it's so expensive. I mean, already the sickle cell anemia drugs is like $2 million for you know, and it's very, very expensive. Only the very wealthy will have the opportunity and to benefit from it. It will exacerbate existing inequalities, permanently genetically encode them into humanity, and create a subclass of enhanced elites and completely undermine basic values of equal opportunity and people being created equal. There's also, of course, concerns about social pressure to edit one's children, because if other people are doing it and I want to keep up with them, national competition, or, you know, creating designer babies and eugenics, and that's, of course, a concern for slippery slopes. But the truth is, these concerns also don't have to be something that prohibits CRISPR or completely prevents us from moving forward with it, because new technologies in general start out expensive and difficult to access, and with time, they become more accessible to everyone. Of course, there's no generic CRISPR yet, so, you know, it's more of a challenge. But if overly restricted, if we would just say, you know what, it's too scary. We don't know about our genome. We don't want to have just the wealthy perfecting themselves and doing all kinds of designer babies and things like that. We have to stay away from CRISPR. If we said this, and this is one of the things that the researchers in my hospital said to me when I was sharing my concerns with it, they said, you know, if we just say we prohibit CRISPR, you cannot engage in gene editing, what will happen instead? Scientists will just move elsewhere. They'll just go to some islands or some place where it's not prohibited, and then only the extremely wealthy and connected will have the ability to take advantage of it, and it will just exacerbate inequalities even more. So prohibition of CRISPR is not necessarily the solution. In fact, you could make a strong argument why we should be engaging in gene editing, because maybe it's unethical not to improve our children's health and well-being and prevent suffering by not editing genes when we have the ability to do so. Maybe it's unethical. Some people call this, you know, having children the way we have children today, sexual roulette. Why would you just engage in sexual roulette and not know what kind of child is going to be born when there are technological possibilities of creating perfect children? I mean, it sounds crazy, but I've heard Dr. Jennifer Doudna speak about this before. She says that when she speaks at conferences, after she speaks, there's lines of people to talk to her. Who are they? People with sick children who come up to her and say, could CRISPR have prevented my child from being sick? And she says, yes. And then they say to her, then why aren't you pursuing it? Why haven't you done it? Why isn't it possible? If you could prevent the illnesses, why wouldn't you do that? We could prevent so much suffering. Maybe it's unethical not to be engaging in it. Judaism, we believe in veripo yirepe. We believe in trying to heal the sick. And our society allows investing in all sorts of advantages for our children, whether that's hiring private tutors. No one says it's unethical to have a tutor, a math tutor, wearing glasses. Do we say, you know what, God gave you bad vision, you're just going to have to deal with it? We say, no, wear glasses, overcome difficult eyesight. We have coaches for sports. Why is it problematic to provide beneficial genes that others get naturally? So, and there's been a lot of discussion about this. Some have said, you know, maybe we should just not have patents in gene editing, and that way you could keep it affordable and available for everyone. But this is the argument on the other side. So perhaps there is, in fact, from a Jewish perspective, some gene editing that could be justifiable. And the truth is, our rabbis have dealt with this. We know that when it came to PGD, pre-implantation genetic diagnosis, which is happening on a regular basis, I guess outside of Alabama, you're right. So that happens all the time. And the rabbis at first confronted it, struggled with it, and permitted it. What did they say? How did they deal with PGD? They said, well, as long as we can distinguish between something that's a medical therapy, like fixing dangerous genetic abnormalities, that would be justifiable, versus enhancements intended just to improve human capacities or traits, that would be difficult to justify. That would, they felt, was playing God. That they quoted the Talmudic phrase, Hanikashi derachmana lamalach. How can you just play God? You can't just create new capabilities. Of course, it's very gray. How do you just decide what's a medical therapy versus what's an enhancement, right? It's so great. What about if someone is below average height and they feel that in their society it's very difficult for them, you know, physically to be too short? So they could say, well, is that a medical concern? What about if their IQ is just below average? And maybe that you could argue is a medical concern, not just an enhancement. So where do we draw the line between medical enhancement, medical therapy, and cosmetic enhancement? Maybe we say, well, it could be for prevention only, but it becomes very gray and difficult to find that fine line. Perhaps there is a place where there is a justifiable red line, because the truth is, for quality of life, the rabbis have allowed medical intervention for quality of life. The proof I would have for that is corneal transplants. The rabbi said you can engage in cornea transplants, is considered pekuach nefesh, is something that it overrides the prohibitions against, you know, treating, burying a dead body, things like that. But it's not to save a life, it's to enhance quality of life. So we see that our rabbis encouraged and allowed medical interventions for quality of life, not just saving life. So I think there's a lot of room. There is one concern that interestingly, a lot of rabbis pick up on the issue of kilayim, of mixing, of interbreeding animals and plant species. And a number of them argue that there is a certain, you know, we curing illness, helping people who are sick, of course, that's a mitzvah. That's a great thing. Creating new species, creating something new, that might be a red line. And that's what they call in bioethics discussions of CRISPR, super enhancements. Developing new capabilities that humans had never possessed before, whether that's the ability to have infrared vision or see new colors on the spectrum that humans can't see, or hear super high frequencies, or prevent aging, which is longevity is also a hot topic right now. So maybe these are things that could be a red line, but quality of life enhancements would be something that could be certainly justifiable. But the main discussion, and I put that transition on purpose for this, is the issue of playing God. This is the issue that the researchers at my hospital asked me about the most. At what point is it playing God, and at what point is it not playing God? And my response was, why is playing God such a bad thing? Who says we can't play God? Okay, I just said to you a minute ago, the rabbi said, "Hanikasha derachman alamalach." You can't play God when it comes to enhancements, whereas you can when it comes to medical therapy. So where's the line there? Where's the line? So playing God is the assumption that we can control the world and that we know, so to speak, how God plays, which we don't. The problem is trying to take powers and control that we don't really have. And the truth is, many in the scientific community in general don't necessarily identify with theological concerns. They're not always concerned about playing God, right? I told you that in my hospital. A lot of researchers brought this up with me, and they shared with me that it's not, you don't find it in conferences and in discussions, people concerned about playing God. But the truth is, even for those who are not concerned about the issue of playing God, I think that the scientific community cannot ignore that question. Because first of all, government funding is essential when it comes to very expensive things like this. We know that. The truth is, I've mentioned it a few times, I didn't plan to mention it at all, but in Alabama, this recent case, the judge actually mentioned God in the ruling. Like, it is actually an issue in our country, especially in many states, where, you know, we have to think about, like, how do we have these conversations about what does it mean to play God? And not just for government funding, but since this technology has the power to impact our entire society, our entire humanity, for generations to come, it's essential to have widely held and well-informed public approval to legitimize it. So we have to be able to have conversations beyond the scientific community. And the truth is, when you read the bioethics literature on CRISPR, many scientific writers couch their concerns in terms that sound like playing God, even though they don't say the word playing God. So for example, these are some quotes. They'll often say, germline gene editing is risky deviation from the natural reproductive process, or the evolutionary process is beyond human capacity to fully understand, making it likely that interference with our genes will result in negative outcomes. Or manipulating mysterious and delicately interwoven forces of nature could undermine crucial traits of empathy, humility, striving for excellence, and appreciation of diversity, which sounds to me a lot similar to the concerns that religious individuals share about playing God. My argument always is that from a Jewish perspective, playing God is a good thing. What do I mean by that? Playing God is partnering with God as a co-creator in creation. We don't just accept imperfections in the world, but we interfere with nature to fight illness and improve the world. So, and the truth is, the Talmud says in a fascinating passage that God created Adam with creative knowledge similar to divine knowledge, which Adam then used to create fire and mate a horse and a donkey to create the mule. And the Talmud praises this, that this is a certain creativity and ability to harness powers, a nature that is a gift from God. And after all, that's what CRISPR is. As has been mentioned before, it is something that occurs in nature, and that scientists have simply figured out how to harness it to help people. It's not that they've made up something new. This is God created CRISPR, as was discussed earlier. So as long as, many of the rabbis point out, playing God is good, as long as the action itself isn't something that's prohibited, doesn't lead to a prohibited act, and the benefits outweigh the risk. The way I would say this is that the issue is not playing God, but playing God. What do I mean by that? Let me say it again. The issue is not playing God, but playing God. Meaning being God-like is good, but not taking that power seriously is a problem. And as long as we can take it seriously, the incredible control we have over the genome, it might be something worth proceeding with just carefully. What I mean by carefully, how do we do that carefully? In bioethics, there's something called the innovation principle. There's something else called the precautionary principle. So some would be called what they would refer to as bioliberals or biotech utopianism. This, by the way, doesn't necessarily translate to politics. Someone could be a bioliberal, let's say Elon Musk, and be a social conservative, right? So you could have bioconservatives or techno-skepticism, right? This is, how do we approach scientific advancement? So, and this also, by the way, relates to the issue of accelerated approval for new drugs. There's a movement called the Right to Try movement, right? Give it a try with before everything is carefully tested and approved, versus those who say, no, we need robust data collection and safety and efficacy in order to help the most people possible. Because sometimes with accelerated approval, it can expose patients to unsafe and ineffective drugs and distract from potentially better trials and divert attention from alternatives. So what approach do we encourage? The precautionary principle or the innovation principle? And my argument is that a Jewish approach says we should move forward with these innovations, but a precautionary principle is essential with something that is so powerful and so risky. This was actually first articulated in 1992 in the United Nations Conference on Environmental and Development for Genetically Modified Agriculture. And the argument basically is that the precautionary principle says we want to move forward with technology. It's a temporary caution. It's a yellow light, basically. It's based on the principle of non-maleficence, that we seek to limit harm while recognizing that research should move forward eventually with the goal of benefiting patients, ultimately being the permanent goal. So the yellow light says the burden of proof regarding safety must be thoroughly demonstrated by advocating for a new therapy or policy before moving forward. First, we recognize the safety, the importance of safety, especially when it comes to CRISPR gene editing, because science has demonstrated that the human genome is much more complex than we previously thought. It's more and more complex every day, and we still don't understand it. Our capabilities have proceeded faster than our knowledge in applying this new technology. So we say, yes, we want to move forward with CRISPR, with gene editing, but not yet. And an example of this, which happened both in the bioethics world, in the medical world, and in the rabbinic world, would be IVF as an example. You know that IVF was initially not supported by government funding. It took a grassroots effort to be proven that it was safe and effective. And so too the rabbis. In fact, there was one great rabbi I just like to use as an example, Rabbi Sternbach, who's a rabbi in Jerusalem today. And he wrote a response in 1980 about IVF, 2 years after the first IVF baby. He wrote a response where he said, IVF is completely forbidden from a Jewish perspective. A few years later, he wrote a response where he said, IVF is a big problem. Most rabbis say it's forbidden. A few years later, the same rabbi said, IVF is forbidden by many and permitted by some. A few years later, he said, many allow it, but I don't. A couple of years later, just a few years ago, he wrote a response where he wrote, IVF is obligatory by Jewish law. The same person who said it's forbidden in 1980, in 2016, said it's obligatory. How did that happen? So I asked him. I asked him, and he said to me, this is how we approach technology and new innovations, is that we have to start off skeptical, but we have to be willing to be proven wrong. Maybe he's a little bit excessively bioconservative, because the question I had for him was, what about all the people that wanted to have a baby in 1982, let's say, who you said no to? And now they find out you say yes now. What about them? He says, well, it might have been much worse if I would have said yes then, and bad things would have happened, and then it would have been much worse. That was his argument. Okay, we can figure out exactly where to, but I think that that's one proof for the precautionary principle within Jewish ethics. So now I just want to start to conclude with what could be a prudent path forward. As long as we could carefully ensure that the safety issues are carefully clinically tested, ethical issues are resolved as well as possible, and social consensus is gradually formed over this being the right way to evolve, then I think it is possible to move forward. These consequential issues have to be settled by society as a whole, not individuals or the scientific community alone. That's why we need public debate and scrutiny. And that could help to educate the broader society, especially crucial to include religious communities in these conversations. Because if they feel that they're being ignored, oftentimes it becomes adversarial. And the goal, which should be, in my opinion, to include religious communities, because this they could even be advocates. It's not something that's intrinsically immoral, and there's opportunity for buy-in. As long as we have humility in developing these new capabilities, the religious community can work with the scientific community to bridge the gap and save a lot of lives. And this is the last point I want to make, because I think it's so important. There's a great book called The Precipice by Toby Ord. I don't know if any of you read it. It's a wonderful book. I think you'll like it. If you're attending this conference, you'll love this book. He's an Oxford professor, and he basically, one of his arguments, the book is about the three biggest threats to human survival, humanity. He actually wrote this in 2019. The biggest threats, he argues, were pandemics. In 2019, he wrote this. Climate change and AI. He has an appendix about nuclear warfare also. A lot of things to worry about. He thinks we can overcome it, but it's going to be a challenge. In one place, at the end of the book, he wrote something that I thought was so interesting and so important. He says, if you think about it, he's not Jewish, but he says, the human civilization is about 5,000 years old. So I love that he says that, because I can quote this in rabbinic conferences and I don't get in trouble. But he says, let's say human civilization is 5,000 years old, approximately. And we have the potential, the ability to live. If you look at other living creatures, we can live for millions of years. So if we're 5,000 years old as a species, but we could live for millions of years, we are sort of like as if, not exactly mathematically, but we're as if we are in the adolescent phase of our maturation of humanity. What is an adolescent? Adolescent is the age at which you have the physical power and the appetite for risk to do a lot of damage, right? You could get into a lot of trouble when you're an adolescent, whether that means hurting people very badly, all kinds of things. But you don't yet have the maturity to deal properly with the ramifications of your actions. So thankfully in society, we have protections for that. We have rules, we have parents, we have police, we have laws, and that hopefully keeps adolescents safe. But as humanity, who are our parents? Who are our guides? And I want to argue that in many ways, first of all, you know, bioethicists, rabbinic leaders, clergy, we need people in society to step up and not just say, oh, it's forbidden, it's too scary, we have to oppose it. But instead to say, how can we move forward properly? How can we have the proper guide rails? And the truth is, even if CRISPR can enhance our intelligence or AI, anything, I don't know that that will necessarily enhance our wisdom. Wisdom is very different than intelligence. And so I just, you know, there's a lot of off-target effects that we mentioned. And there could be horrible off-target effects that if we don't take this technology seriously enough, we could fall trap to these impacts. And so I just want to close with a quote that when I read this, it made me think about CRISPR, even though it wasn't related, because there could be moral off-target effects, how we live our lives. Imagine changing the way we relate to disease, illness, longevity. What will that do to our desire to accomplish things in life and our recognition of the fragility of life? So I read this quote from Rabbi Sacks that I'm going to close with because it moved me so much and I thought it was so relevant. Rabbi Sacks asks, he says, whenever I finish reading the Torah and Moses dies, I feel like so disappointed. We didn't make it to the promised land. He didn't get to go in. He dies. He didn't get to lead it. Like, it's just a sad ending to the story. And then he writes, and the truth is this was published right after he died. He wasn't even published in his lifetime. But here it is. He says, I became comforted when I realized, though, that the Torah was teaching us a lesson when Moses dies at the end of the story. Why? Because it teaches us three things. One, that Moses was mortal, that the greatest leader who ever lived did not see his mission completed, that even he was capable of making a mistake, is the most profound gift God could have given each of us. Hence, the three great life-changing ideas with which the Torah ends. One, we are mortal, therefore make every day count. We are fallible, therefore learn to grow from each mistake, and we will not complete the journey. Therefore, inspire others to continue what we began. There's a lot of challenges with gene editing and the capabilities we have today. It doesn't mean we shouldn't do them, but it does mean we need leadership, and we need to think a lot about how we're going to advance and how we're going to grow, because there's scientific off-target effects, there's moral off-target effects, there's risks, but there's a lot of benefit. And if we want to see those benefits, and I hope we will see those benefits, because we can reduce a lot of suffering and a lot of pain in the world, we should do so very carefully, with a lot of precaution, and also a lot of hope, because the future brings a lot of excitement, potential, and we can all work together to make that potential as successful and safe as possible. Thank you.
What halakhic framework can help us tackle these issues brought up by the use of CRISPR? So, I think you talked about it a little bit, but if you want to go into it, that was your talk, but if you want to...
Right. Yeah, I mean, there are those who see the Hanikashi de Rahmana, the playing God, as actually a halakhic issue. And the truth is, a lot of the issues that I mentioned are... depending on what a person's halakhic concerns are, so those are all halakhic issues. But,
yeah. No, I would just amplify what Jason had presented, is that one of the discussions is, where is the line between therapy and enhancement? And
right.
I think the answer was, you shouldn't do it, right?
Right. Well, one of the things that brought this all up was that the recent heart transplant from a pig, which didn't end up working out, but there's still hope that it's going to work out. One of the questions people asked rabbis when they saw that people were getting, because that's related to CRISPR also, just because these were genetically modified pigs to be more human-like. And then people were asking, well, can a heart from a pig? So the answer is, as long as you don't eat it, because there's no prohibition against benefiting from pig. You just can't eat the pig. But we get heart valves from pigs all the time. So, of course, it's permissible.
Anybody else have
On pigs, there's ancient evidence that the Israelites in antiquity farmed pigs.
There weren't any real red lines, that everything was permissible with caution. But I wanted to clarify that was right, because at the end, Jonathan Sacks talked about these things, and one of the things about being mortal, and the question then is immortality or mortality, is that sort of a limit from your perspective? Then the question for Jonathan, again, with the temperamental versus material, I got the sense that maybe the temperamental was an area where there were limits from a Judaic perspective, but then in your answer to Chava, it sounded like maybe not. So I was just curious about clarifying your positions on that question.
Yeah, thank you. Sorry if it wasn't clear. I do think that there's a red line. And the red line that I suggested was super enhancements, what we call super enhancements, which are things which you cannot find in nature, meaning a human could not normally achieve. It's one thing to overcome illness, but another thing to create human beings that would never have been created in nature, that have superhuman abilities. And I said that was based, I suggested that based on the prohibition of kilayim and interbreeding of different species in nature, that some of the commentaries say the reason that's prohibited is because there's a prohibition against creating new species, and that maybe that would be a red line for CRISPR, even though other areas I felt that could be justified with proper precautions. The argument I was trying to make with Rabbi Sacks, and maybe I didn't clarify it well, but even though I was suggesting a somewhat bioconservative approach by advocating for the precautionary principle, which someone could say that that's somewhat conservative, why aren't you just embracing new technologies and new possibilities of saving lives? My argument was that it actually could be in some ways more progressive to be bioconservative in certain ways, because if the human body is perfected, meaning, let's say we don't age, or we slow down the possibility of aging. What incentive will there be for the old to make way for the young? Or if the young aren't given a chance to lead, might this lead to prolongation of functional immaturity? So my argument is sort of that by being overly optimistic or overly aggressive and overly bioliberal, we actually might slow down progress in some ways because people need opportunity. You know, if we achieve a state where, like, people, let's say people are living to be 180, 200 years old, and CEOs aren't retiring until they're 150 years old, is that a good thing? Meaning the next generation doesn't have a chance to lead. And next generations oftentimes have perspectives that are new and essential for human progress. And so, like, there is something built into humanity that we have the next generation taking over, and there's always problems and solutions to those problems that help humanity move forward. And so part of the concern is if we try to just fix every problem, do we slow down progress, actually, and the human need to strive to develop new things and create new ideas and come up with new solutions? And so it actually, in some ways, it might promote progress by slowing down certain types of scientific progress, moral progress, yeah. Promote moral progress, yeah. So.
Actually,
if I could, just one more point, just because I think it's relevant for both of our presentations. If the overall goal is promoting human progress and flourishing, there's a fascinating source that when the Torah says on the sixth day of creation, it was Tov Meod. Every other day was Tov. The final day is Tov Meod. So the Midrash says, Tov is Chaim, Tov Meod, Mavet. Why is death so good? So one of the explanations, Rabbeinu Bachaye, the commentary on the Torah, says, if it wouldn't be that we would die, there would be no desire for progress of the next generation. You would force, you know, there would be no sense, no need for innovation. And so that actually that death is a motivator for people, and so that actually is Tov Meod. So that was fascinating. I think it's relevant. Right.
This would be for Rabbi Wiener, where when you concluded, you said, well, CRISPR's okay if we resolve the safety issues, we resolve the ethical issues, the public is engaged in debate and scrutiny. So I say, well, that sounds very reasonable. But the whole part of your talk before was about God and playing God and these rabbinic sources, and but you end with just good secular reasons why what we should do with. So why muck the whole discussion up with obscure entities like, unknowable entities like God, and all these rabbinic passages from all over the place that we, who knows what they mean or what were intended. Why get involved with the whole Jewish religion and all of these questions? What good does it really do?
Well, yeah, that's a great question, but if you care, if you make your decisions and you try to base your values on Jewish values, so you want to, first of all, I want to muck it up because it is complicated. It's not something that we should just answer so easily. And also, I do think that the issue of playing God and being careful, like to me, one of my most important points, and I try to think about a lot, the issue of playing God versus playing God. Playing God versus playing God. Like, to actually take these decisions seriously, that these are really big decisions that could alter the course of humanity. And so, therefore, we should muck it up. I mean, we should ask difficult questions. We should be thinking to ourselves, am I doing this right? I have to be careful. Even if my conclusion is the same as the second conclusion, we have to include religious communities because, as we see, so much of decision, so many medical decisions are made in society today based on religious values, sometimes not for the good. I mean, it depends on your perspective. From my perspective, sometimes not for the good. And if we want to be able to have religion and Judaism as part of the public space and the public conversation, which many other religions are part of the public conversation, we have a lot of wisdom too. And we should be able to share that wisdom. And I think it is important to kind of be able to use our vocabulary to explain why we do what we do and why we don't do what we don't do.
Yeah. And then we have to wrap up this one.
Furthermore, at the end of the day, we have to recognize that, you know, we believe that Torah values are truth. They are conveying some true eternal values that we believe in. And so if we believe in them, we believe they're true, we want to live by them. Also, I just want to conclude with one last point, which is that I did mention the issue of Kalayim, and we take that seriously in terms of there was a psak ruling regarding, you know, the certain red lines in terms of not creating super enhancements. But in general, the Kalayim concern we doesn't hold us back from genetic engineering and different types of medical advancements. You know, we say that Kalayim, you know, some, the Rambam says it only applies in Israel, and Rambam says it's a chok, we don't know the reason. And so a Kalayim is not a concern that holds us back with everything. But just regarding this one point of super enhancements as a red line for CRISPR, I think it does have some value and some usage there.